Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Big Ticket, Variety and iHeart's movie podcast. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. This week, I sit down with Jamie Bell, who talks about transforming into a neo-Nazi for his new real-life drama, Skin. And then there's Rocket Man. Jamie reveals what worried him most about shooting the Elton John biopic. And wait till you hear Jamie's Cher impression. I have that and a whole lot more coming up after the break. Stick around. Welcome back to The Big Ticket. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. Here's Jamie Bell.
Hello, Jamie Bell.
Hey, man.
How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Good. I'm glad you're here. We have a lot to talk about. But congrats on becoming a member of the Academy.
I know. I do.
How exciting is
it? It is exciting. Yeah. It was kind of... My agent sent to me and just wrote, congratulations. What does that mean? That's all you're going to write? Because I still consider myself a kid from, like, this tiny, like, mining town in England. I do, yeah. And just so not a part of a club in any way. But no, I feel very flattered and very honored to be a part of it. Yeah.
But what does it mean to be a member of the Academy?
I mean, it means a lot to me. I mean, you're doing the job that you're doing because you love doing it, right? And sometimes you can feel included and part of the club with certain movies, and then sometimes you don't feel included and you feel like you're really on the periphery and you're like looking into everything. And there's a ceremony once a year where the best of the best are in a room, and most of the time you're on a couch looking at it. And and they always talk about a community, and sometimes you feel a part of it and sometimes you don't. I don't know. There's just something that feels them being invited into that. I don't know. I feel very honored about it. I really do. I unapologetically feel very excited by it.
Good.
Yeah,
I don't want you to be depressed. Okay, let's talk about Skin.
Sure.
Describe for people who don't know anything about the short, who don't know about the movie, describe it.
The film is a kind of unflinching look at a man who made horrible choices and then, because of the kindness of strangers, was given a new shot at life. And I don't think the film is necessarily a movie that says, look, people can change. I hope that the film is framing a question, which is people who've made these decisions and these choices, who've had hardships trying to get themselves out of that, can they ever truly change, although they may be changed on the surface?
Tell me about your character. I don't want to say character because he's a real person.
Sure.
Tell us about.
Well, he's a man who was very wayward as a child. He's someone who didn't have any kind of particular role models and was kind of drafted into this way of thinking, these ideologies. He's someone who embraced them as well. He's someone who lived a life of criminality, of hatred and intolerance and bigotry. I think when we meet him in the film, he's someone who is kind of unconscious to a degree. I think he's even lost touch as to why he hates these people. Certainly that specific group's ideology is based in Norse mythology, which means kind of Vikings.
Mm-hmm. Which that like, confused. I didn't just, know that
it's
was
just,
a thing.
Well, the truth is, it's just utter nonsense. It's right. Garbage is what it is. Right. So he kind of believed that, I think, at some point, and then has become kind of disillusioned to a degree, but is so in the cycle of violence and alcohol and self-harm that I think he's lost touch with what it even means, you know.
How do you even begin to play a neo-Nazi? What kind of, you watch the short, sure. What kind of research do you do? Because that's a dark place to go for research.
I mean, my Amazon checkout box was a little questionable at a few points.
You know, imagine.
Just some of the material that I was buying and looking at. But it's a really icky, unpleasant place to kind of be in. The hardest thing for me in terms of prep was always, how do you betray this sense of detachment from things, from feeling or from empathy or from compassion? This is a character that's certainly so far away from who I am as a human being, right. The things that I believe in. So accessing that and bringing that to work every day was always going to be the hardest part. But I flew and met with the real guy, Brian.
What was that like? How does that happen?
I mean, I was very scared, honestly. There was a lot of fear and trepidation about doing this movie.
Why?
I was worried. I think that these are a group of people that are not to be messed with, really. They are organized, they're armed. They've shown, and they continue to show, that they're people who don't mind being out in daylight. They don't care that their faces are out carrying torches, saying the things that they're saying, carrying the slogans that they're carrying. So just from literal sense of safety, wow. I was afraid. But this is a man who's in the witness protection program. He's been in it for a long time. He's in an undisclosed location. So all of this stuff, when you're a family man like me, was a little daunting, to be honest with you. So I went up and met with him. Literally driving to his house, I saw a guy kind of driving on the highway, and he had a pistol in his hand, just kind of hanging out of the car. And I was like, where are we right now? What is going on? And I spent like a week essentially in his garage, and he would smoke 60 cigarettes in an hour. And I'd say, can we open the garage door? Because I'm going to die if you don't. And he said, we might die if you open the garage door as well. So he lives perpetual paranoia and fear, which he's earned. But he also lives in regret, guilt, even through the kindness that he's been shown. I still think
What do you want to know from him? Because like what you're saying is like something that's so far from us. Mm-hmm. How do you begin to understand a human who has literally no empathy for people?
I wanted to know how it's possible. What was it about this group that made you so compliant? Ironically, he had said that he'd suffered racism himself as a child in school. He was at a predominantly Hispanic school, and he felt marginalized because he was the only white person.
There's a lot to be said about that.
I was very clear with him up front. I said, like, I don't agree with anything you've done. I don't think I'm going to play this character as a hero. This character isn't a hero. Mm-hmm. He's a vessel for a possibility of change. He said, you know, there were people who were willing to give him a beer, give him a slap on the back, tell him he did a good job, only he wasn't doing something noble. He was, you know, beating the crap out of someone. And for him at that point in time, that was enough. So trying to understand that, trying to wrap your head around that is impossible.
What did he tell you the reason that one day he said, you know, this isn't for me? I mean, it's not one day, it's a gradual...
Sure. It's a gradual ebbing away at that. But I think these kids, especially seeing the innocence in these children, seeing that this woman, Danielle McDonald plays her in the film, seeing, even though to our standards there is no stability in her life, I think for him, seeing some measure of stability and self-possession, where she didn't owe anything to anyone. I think Brian always felt like he owed to this group. He owed to turn up to these meetings, owed to drink with them. She was independent of that, and I think that was really enticing for him. And apparently unlocking these caverns of feelings and emotions that I guess he actually did truly have, that he didn't know he could access.
So you put on 20 pounds.
Sure.
Fake teeth.
Yeah.
Contacts. Uh-huh. And your face, your body is covered in the most horrendous tattoos.
Yeah.
What was it like to look at yourself in the mirror for the first time in full makeup and wardrobe?
I wasn't really buying it initially. It just felt like we just slapped a bunch of tattoos on my face, honestly. Mm. I also have these like ears. I talk about this a lot. I have these like kind of big ears. They're transmitting the wrong message. This kind of they're transmitting like a, I don't know, like a boyness, like a sweetness, like a childlike quality, if you will. So I was like, this is completely wrong. We did all this kind of stuff to try and figure it out. Like, you know, we had these like applications kind of built so that they could like attach to my ear and then stick to the side of my head to try and hide them, to make me kind of more streamlined. And it wasn't really until I shaved the head and the teeth weren't originally on the table. We kind of thought that we wanted something that had like a snaggle tooth to him, where he looked just vicious when he spoke. There was like something that was like even garish in the way when he opened his mouth. Like smiling was like difficult for him, you know. And then contact lenses and everything else. And then putting on all the weight, that was finally, I looked in the mirror, I was like, oh, well, I don't recognize myself. But also I kind of look like a shark almost. There's something very intensely predatory about him. These dark, dull eyes with no life in them, these teeth poking out, and this shaved kind of hard skin on his head. It felt like kind of who he was, cold, violent, always moving, always looking at you, and you'll never know when he's gonna attack you violently. So kind of used that really for the character a little bit. But initially I didn't really buy it, I wasn't buying it.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Jamie Bell, I don't think of...
Sure, Bernie Taupin, Rocketman, like, you know, wholesome films.
Yeah.
Sure, that one
we'll
too.
We'll get to that in a second. How do you go home after a day of shooting a movie like that, or back to your hotel, wherever, and just how do you decompress from something like that? It has to get literally under your skin.
I thought I was doing a good job at it, honestly. Mm-hmm. I'm always someone who, like, I'm acting as acting, and you take the costume off and you check it at the door, and, you know, there's no cameras anymore, and you just walk home. It really wasn't until I was done and the film was over, and it'd been a hard 6 weeks. We were living in, like, a Best Western in Kingston for that whole time. Mm. It was pretty...
Kingston, New York.
Yeah, it was tough. It was, like, there's just no money, like, really making it for peanuts. And I went home, and a week later, my wife was just like, just go take a walk. Or, like, just go jog it off or something. And it's true, like, you do kind of, you're carrying around a heaviness, like this character's on edge for so many different reasons. I thought it wasn't an issue, but she disagreed.
And when you're making the movie, do you ever think, unfortunately, it's resonating today? Like, I don't think you could have imagined. I mean, we had a president this weekend.
I knew. I mean, like, you know, the first time I talked to Brian on Skype was the day of Charlottesville.
The
exact same. But he actually had to get off the phone so he could call his friend Daryl Jenkins, who was there. He's the guy who's always on the front lines. He's the African-American man in the film. And he's the man who is, he's always there. Whenever there's a rally with those hateful people, he's always in their faces on the front lines, opposing them. Doing the thing that I think we all, frankly, should be doing, but we're too scared to. And he needed to know that he was okay because he hadn't heard from him. But regardless of that, I got off the phone with him and I said to Guy, our director, I said, I don't think we should be making this movie, man. I think yeah, it's too incendiary right now. It's too explosive. We're in a world where it's being emboldened. It's not like they're walking in the streets. They're in broad daylight. They're showing their faces. And I toiled with that constantly during the making of it, even now, like just this past weekend, you know, with the comments that this president's made today, he doubles down on them, you know. I'm aware that we're asking someone, it's a big ask of an audience to sit through this movie. But again, I don't think it's hopefully it's portraying these people in the way that they should be portrayed. These are horrible and intolerant people. These are bigoted, hateful individuals with dangerous and violent.
Vera Farmiga?
Unbelievable, yeah. Most of that stuff wasn't even written or scripted. She came up with most of that stuff herself, and I had no idea that she was going to go to the level that she went to it with.
I wanted to look away when she was on.
Sure. Horrible.
It was horrible. And the fact that they called her Ma cemented it in a way that was just beyond creepy.
Yes, yeah.
But, you know, this is a movie, you know, listen, like you said, this guy's living in constant paranoia. He's in witness protection. He's earned it. Mm-hmm. But there is something to say, like, someone as evil and unfeeling and, frankly, unhuman as he was could change.
Sure. I mean, I think it's a sign of our times. I think under a different administration, quite honestly, I think maybe you and I, could extend our hands of compassion to that person and say, like, wow, you know... challenging, but it's possible. Right. This current climate, it's so intense, it's so hard to ask for that. You know, our filmmaker, he's a Jewish man, he's an Israeli man. His family were persecuted in the Second World War by the Nazis. I find it fascinating that this man has dedicated so much of his time to try and tell this story, to extend that sense of compassion and ask that question, is it possible?
And I was reading an interview with him in which he said that when he was first shopping the script around...
No one wanted it, yeah.
No one wanted it because they're like, oh, Hillary Clinton's going to be president.
Well, first of all, they were like, that doesn't exist in America anymore. Like, that's an old world kind of thing. Right. Like, we dealt with that. You know, I mean, even in all my research, like, you see how many chapters there are of this stuff across the country. I mean, the map is littered with it. Some in larger, some smaller, most of them aren't.
Did all the research just leave you hopeless?
No, I mean, Trump leaves me hopeless a little bit. Yeah, I do, because there is so much of it that it just needs someone at the front to lead it, mm-hmm. to level it out, to push it back in the darkness. I mean, I think there are great organizations trying to pull people out, trying to help people get out. There's also organizations who are targeting them and holding them accountable for what they do. But as long as we have someone who's saying the kind of things that they're saying, they're only going to be more emboldened. They're only going to draft in more people. And people who I think were always kind of teetering on the edge of that are just going to fall into it now. It's so easy to fall into that stuff.
Is there a part of you that says, you know what, I'm going back to England?
I can't because I have kids here now. So there's a part of me that's worried for the future of my kids, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't want another four years of this, you know. It's just too depressing. I mean, I think we feel it, right? I mean, just driving here today, I was like, God, everything that happened over the weekend totally reframes this conversation in the past 48 hours. It really does.
And it'll probably by the time we wrap this.
Yes, I know.
It's going to be something different.
Yeah.
Right now, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, Jamie talks Rocket Man and surprises me with a Cher impression. Plus, would Jamie ever take another shot at the superhero world after having starred as the Thing in the infamous 2015 bomb Fantastic Four? Find out after the break. Stick around. Here's more of Jamie Bell.
On a completely different note, sure. Rocket Man!
Yeah.
Okay, let's just talk about your transformation there. That wig.
Yeah.
Tell me about putting that wig on for the first time.
I wasn't sure about that wig, man.
It's itchy. It looked really itchy.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the wig. Dexter loved it. Our director loved it. I mean, here's the thing. When you look at reference of, and I love Bernie Taupin, by the way, we're very good friends. But when you look at actual reference of Bernie Taupin from that time, he didn't have the best hair choices either, I would say.
No one did.
So this is actually an improvement on that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, itchy. And like you become aware of like how you're acting because you can. I like touching my face a lot and doing stuff, but you become aware of what you can't.
Where you're putting your hand behind your ear.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the thing about that movie. I was so relieved to go and make that film after, you know, this after Skin.
Sure.
I was just so thankful.
That said, though, Rocket Man has its darkness too.
Oh, sure. No, of course. I mean,
it's much different darkness, and Bernie stuck with Elton.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess as a character and also as a person, when you love someone that intensely and you see them going through something so horrific and, you know, they're just spiraling. It's hard being that person. It's also just as hard to be the person who's watching them go through it, you know. But to this day, he remains his most loyal friend. It's lovely seeing them interact today,
So what was it like seeing Taron for the first time as Elton? Like, what was that in character? When did you see him for the first time?
Well, I kind of got to this, got to London and saw what he was doing. And he'd actually sent me videos of him singing, which I thought was a bit intense because, like, I knew that I had to sing in the movie as well. So I was like, oh, man, come on. But I guess it did make everyone kind of step up their game a little bit. But I was blown away by what he was doing. I mean, I really was. I'd go up to Dexter after takes and just say to him, like, oh, he's really good, isn't he? He's so versatile, I think, Taron. And I think the world has really kind of gotten to see that now. I'm really thankful that they have. But I would just enjoy sitting outside of his trailer every day and just seeing what he'd be wearing. And just getting to see, you know, what him and Richard Madden would be doing. And, you know,
what weren't they doing?
There was like, you know, Richard came back, he was like, oh no, he's Scottish. He was like, no, I have to wear a kimono. I've got to wear a kimono in this scene. And I was like, that is absolutely perfect. And you should. I can't wait to see it. It was just an inventive, fun, creative. Dexter said just his note to everyone. He just went to go as far as you can. And everyone really felt like they had the license to kind of take it off the leash. And I appreciated that, certainly coming from the other movie. So. Yeah, it's a bold film. I really like that Paramount really got behind it and stuck with it, and we got to tell the story in that way. I can't imagine it being told in any other way, really.
How important was it that Taron did his own singing? What a difference that makes.
Yeah, I mean, it does. I mean, it gives him complete authorship over the performance to a degree where, you know, if he wasn't doing that. Also, I think that here's the thing. The difference between the two is that we're using the music differently. Mm-hmm. Where the music is becoming narrative. It's not a concert. It's not just like play the hits.
Right.
We want Goodbye Yellow Brick Road to feel a certain way. It has to feel like I've lost him.
Right.
And now I've lost myself and I'm out of this business. That's what that song was for me. But, you know, that, and in some ways the song kind of is that, you know, in its true iteration. But, you know, thematically we needed it to sound different. So we needed him to perform the songs differently. Mm. And we're just very lucky that he had pipes of a champion, a Welshman with these intense pipes.
So did you take pipe lessons, more pipe lessons, once you saw his videos?
I took a lot of pipe lessons.
Did you?
Yeah, he has a lovely guy in the valley that I went to see. He does everyone. He said, let me just hear you. And I was so nervous to like hit it out that first time. I was like, oh, fuck. Because by the way, I used to like sing. I used to be in the National Youth Music Theatre. That's where I started as a kid. And I would do all these auditions.
How you're justifying this, by the way. This is amazing.
My mum would take me on all these fucking auditions when I was a kid, right? And if it was dense, I'd be there all day. But if it was singing, I come out after 30 minutes, she'd be like, what happened? She'd be like, they asked me to sing. She'd be like, oh, let's get back on the train. So I always had this like association with singing, like, it's just a disaster, just don't even try. So I,
and now you have to sing Elton John.
Yeah, sure, which by the way is in the highest falsetto voice he's ever sung a song in. So I popped it out for this lovely man, and he went, it's not terrible. I was like, that's probably the best note I've ever heard. It's probably the best note I've ever heard. But I really enjoyed doing it. I was nervous about it because we recorded at Abbey Road, which is insane. And there's no, I should never be there recording anything at Abbey Road, to be frank. But it was enjoyable. I really got into it in the end. It's such a, singing is such a great therapy session. It really is.
So come on, sing something for me.
You gotta come down. Sorry, it's more like Cher, wasn't it? Do you believe in life after love?
Okay, that's
here's the thing. I think I do a reasonably good Cher impression.
Keep going.
No, I don't know that. Feel something inside me say, I really don't think it's strong. Is it good? I mean, do you think it's good? Doesn't think it's good. My wife is like,
well, I see what you're doing. You're doing it out of the side of your mouth, so you think that's Cher.
Fuck, it's not good, is it?
Yeah, you need the Bernie.
No,
talent.
I went into
you need the wig. You need
the
wig.
And the suspenders. If I could turn. Yeah.
You are a Cher.
Yeah, I love Cher. I can't wait for the Cher movie.
Cher movie, the Cher show. There's the Cher show.
Oh, of course it's the Cher show.
I do want to talk to you about the legacy of Billy Elliot.
Sure.
Because on a personal front.
Yeah.
That was me as a kid.
Oh, right. It was.
And I could start crying.
Yeah.
I was the kid who took dancing lessons.
Right.
Begged my father.
Yeah.
My father reluctantly did it because my grandmother told him that he had to.
Right. Good grandmother.
Yeah, but I would take dancing lessons, and I grew up in Queens, New York, very sort of, as much as it was New York City, it wasn't New York City.
Uh-huh.
And I would take dancing lessons, and in the neighborhood, at the end of the year, they would have a big recital.
Sure.
And everyone would come.
Sure.
So a week before dancing school ended,
yeah,
I quit because everyone wanted to see me. Next year comes around, I'm like, Dad, please, I won't quit this time.
Right.
Fine.
Right.
I do it a week before and I quit.
Mm.
I bawled watching Billy Elliot. Yeah, and then when I saw the musical, I almost had to leave the theater.
Yeah. Well, it's weird because by the time the musical came out, the great Tom Holland was in it as well. I was so far away from my kind of old life in a way
mm-hmm.
that even I was kind of like still getting, you know, emotional about it. And just like because as I grew up and started making movies, kind of said goodbye to my mom in the same way that Billy says goodbye to his dad. Like, it was very cathartic seeing the musical. But Elton John, by the way, was the same. He was in Cannes at the premiere when it wasn't even called Billy Elliot at the time. It was called Dancer. That was originally what it was called. And that was the first time I met him, and it was like 13 or 14 or something. And he was weeping too. And doing the research for Rocketman, because I didn't understand at the time. Obviously, the film goes into this. His father never approved of him. And everything else, but his dad also never saw him perform, ever, not once. So when Billy's dad turns up at the end of the movie to see him dance as an older man, it killed him. Yeah.
Wow.
So I think it's a really, for me, it's such a great vessel of a story because you can throw so. It's so opaque. You can be that character, or you can be the dad trying to accept, or you can be the teacher who never quite fulfilled her potential, you know. It's just a great universal story by Lee Hall, who also wrote Rocketman as well. But I'm so privileged to have carried that torch and so privileged to have gotten to play such an amazing role out the gate, that I'm forever kind of, I'm owing my career to that, you know. Every time, I'm always thankful for it. Like, it always goes back to that for me, you know. And it spawned all these other opportunities for me that I could never dreamed of, so... I'm very grateful for that.
Well, thank you for the movie.
Yeah.
Got to talk to you about another thing, though, you've done.
Sure.
Superhero movies. Would you ever do them again?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
But it's a different
Sure. You know? Yeah, no, I know.
Who knew that they would become what they've become?
No, of course. Right. I mean, they're an amazing currency. I love those movies. I would. Of course you would. I like... the movies that I've been doing, you know, mm-hmm. I really like these kind of more challenging. Certainly, Skin is a challenging film. It requires something different, I think, for me as an actor. But I think we all on the movie I did. I think we're kind of dancing around it, but
I'm
Fantastic Four. I think most people fondly refer to it as Fan-Four-Stick. whatever. You know, it was such a very specific experience for all of us. But again, we all went into it with the best of intentions, yeah. and I got something great out of it. I got my wife out of it.
I was just going to say, you know what?
And now
it's a pretty fantastic.
It, so
now it's Fantastic Three.
Yeah, you've got to find your blessings and everything, exactly. So, yes, of course, there's so many different characters out there. I'd love to play one at some point.
But then you go and you play a freaking neo-Nazi white supremacist in a way
that might have put
just,
a kibosh on there, I suppose.
I mean, I told you this the other night. I mean, it's just so powerful. And what we haven't talked about yet is that, you know, this woman, this anonymous donor, donated money so he could have all of those white power tattoos removed from his face. And what I find so powerful about the movie is what Guy, the director, did was like, we're waiting, you know, we know the tattoos are removed, and we just see the back of your head, and I'm like, I want to see what it looks like, and I'm like, oh, wait a minute, I know what Jamie Bell looks like. Like, it's literally, you turn around, like, oh, of course, it's Jamie Bell.
Sure.
But it's amazing how the movie really, you could see your shoulders went down. Your shoulders weren't up anymore. It was, you were free, and the fact that they were able to do that knowing that you're so well known.
Yeah, I mean, of course, that scene comes 2 hours. It's literally like the final scene in the film.
Yep.
It was the first day of filming. So
how
I mean, it's so intense, the shit that they ask you to do.
But that's indie film.
No, like, I know, of course. But for Guy, I said, like, Guy, I'm not gonna make it happen. I can't. I mean, it's day one. Like, I have no clue where we're going to go with this. So I said, the only way I can really do it is if we have to play some music through it. You're just going to have to, like, redub the sound, and, like, you're going to have to do all the sound later. It's just no way I'm going to be able to get it. So, and I played, like, because I put my kid to bed with this thing every day, with this lullaby every day, so the crew must have been so...
Is it Cher?
Like, what the
hell?
Yeah, it's like, do you believe in life after love? So just when you watch it, that's what's fun. No, it's a lullaby for my kid that I put him to sleep to, and it was just the only way that I could really manage to conjure really anything. I should probably take some acting classes. But yeah, hard way to start the movie, but... Yeah, and I hope that scene is, it's a threshold, right? Because you never really see him enter. So we don't know, like, what happens when it goes black. We don't know, like, if she's going, come in and be, you know, and I accept you. Or it's also saying, what is the future of this kid going to be? What's his, like, you know, is he going to inherit all this hate and this bigotry and this intolerance? Because that's what it is. It is learned.
Right, because when the scene when we learn she's pregnant, my first thing is like, oh, no,
another one.
Don't bring a kid
There's
into
another
this.
One. Yeah, yeah, no, of course. And I think it's a cycle. And I hope that that cycle for this little chapter of these people's lives is it ends right there at the door, as I hope it ends in this country and all over the world. It's horrible.
So Danielle McDonald, have you seen Bird Box? Did you see her throw herself out the window in Bird Box? He's like, nope.
I have seen Bird Box. I don't remember that.
Don't you?
I don't remember
That's
that.
That's how she kills herself.
Oh, right.
She
right.
literally doesn't just right. throw herself yeah, out yeah. the window. Like just
No,
like
she launches herself out of the window. Oh, God. Danielle's the best.
She's so awesome.
She's the best. She made like this movie so... I felt so supported by her in this role. We have like a lot of dark, horrible, intense scenes, and we're always trying to like rationalize why these characters do the things they're doing. And Guy was like, "Guys,
there's no
they're
rationale.
Irrational people, like
right.
you know." So Sid and Nancy was a big reference for us as characters who kind of are in love, but it's so heightened
dark.
And so bizarre. Yeah, but there's a couple of scenes where just afterwards we would just look at each other and just be like, "Can you believe that we're doing this?" You know. But she's a hero. I love her. She's great. I had a great time with her.
Sure, her also. So I literally have spoken to her about this a few times. I'm just like, you literally hurl yourself.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and she had just given birth. Okay.
Yeah, sure.
The character.
Sure, right.
So I end my podcast interviews with, when was the last time you cried at the movies?
Oh, man. I really wept at Star Is Born. I know that was like a while ago, and there's been like tons of other movies.
Go ahead.
No.
I mean, you've
really,
done Cher, A Star
really
Is Born. You're just playing to everything.
No, but it really was intense. I got so caught off guard by that. How did you respond emotionally to that film? I mean, because some people.
I'm a gay Jew from New York.
Right.
The Barbra Streisand version is, you know, my life.
Sure. Okay.
So then Lady Gaga goes and does
I mean,
I saw it once.
Yeah.
I saw it in Toronto.
Yeah.
And then my husband hadn't seen it yet, and I went because I just wanted to watch my husband watch it. I know that sounds really corny, but I love watching him watch movies. It's weird. And I watched him watch it, and I watched him cry, and then I cry, and yeah, it's intense.
I went into the bathroom afterwards. I saw it with my wife in London while I was shooting Rocketman, actually, and I went into the toilet, and Have you ever like peed and cried before?
That's a messy toilet.
It was really, really strange. It was really strange. I was sobbing, like uncontrollable. It was very.
Sorry, I'm just getting the visual.
Very odd. No, it was really. I was so overwhelmed by it because I was like, oh, I'm not going to be a sucker for this. I'm not going to get brought to this. And then it really. That's the thing with movies, right? You don't know what it is that you can be so caught off guard by it. And I love when that happens. I really do. I hope movies endure because of that. You know, and we're not losing that because everything's on TV now.
And what's the one movie you could watch over and over again? Like you're flipping the channels.
Silence of the Lambs. I know that's odd and
weird.
I know it's odd and weird, but it's so just brilliantly executed. The performances are so like theatrical and kind of heightened. Clarice like literally metamorphoses like throughout the film. She, you know, when she gets into Buffalo Bill's house, she sheds that coat. Like I've watched the making of. Like I know so much about this movie. I love Jonathan Demme's films. I know the dialogue inside out. I must have seen it 100 times.
So do it. Side of beans. What is it?
Nice can father. A sentence taker once tried to test me. I'm not going to do it.
Just a little.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice can. I'm not going to do that.
I'll do share.
Yeah, I'll do share. Sure, but not the great.
Okay, do share as Hannibal Lecter.
No, I can't because you're going to sing it. You're going to sing it. It doesn't work.
You're awesome.
Thank you so much for your time, Zoe. Privilege to be honest. Thank you.
That was Jamie Bell. Thanks for listening to The Big Ticket. I'm your host, Mark Malkin. And don't forget, a new episode of The Big Ticket drops every Thursday. And make sure to follow me on Twitter and Instagram @MarkMalkin. See you next week.